Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to chumbacasino.com.
Chumbacasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, as you know, we have some criticisms of the Conservative Party, and you probably picked that up from our election night coverage and much of our other coverage. And of course, we did the excellent stream with Apostolic Majesty last week, going through the obituary of the Conservative Party. And in that, Apostolic Majesty made some excellent points that really helped gel my thinking on why the party has got itself into this sort of issue and the sort of factionalism within it. But of course, we are both outsiders. I have spent some time in Parliament. I've done a couple of stints working in Parliament and even CCHQ a long time ago when it was at its former address in Smith Square. But I haven't been a Conservative MP, so I haven't been able to see it from the inside. Well, in this episode, I wanted to talk with somebody who has actually been on the inside of it. And as frustrating as it must have been for us on the outside, if you are actually inside the party and having Conservative instincts, it must have been a somewhat torturous experience. So I thought to myself, who do I know who can talk about that? And then I thought, it's got to be Marcus. Marcus Fish, welcome to Brokenomics.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, and particularly the turn that your life took in 2015.
Well, I have a background in business and in fund management. That's what I started out doing. I used to manage money.
What mandate did you look after?
I did Asia Pacific equities and global equities, and I was the Asia point person on our global equities team for Mercury Asset Management that became Merrill Lynch Investment Managers back in the day. And then after I left there, I went and lived in Asia and Australia, and I did sort of venture capital, private equity advisory on a boutique sort of a basis.
And
ended up being an entrepreneur, starting up a business doing affordable housing in India. And that was very interesting. So
not a wildly dissimilar background to myself then. So
lots of experience of all different places, different politics, different investments, different sectors, different economics. So that kind of, but I wanted to kind of give back. And so when I moved back to the UK and met my lovely wife, I decided to get involved first in the local politics. And then as I kept winning pretty much unwinnable on paper seats at the local level, I decided to stand for Parliament and stood in Yeovil, where I was doing my local politics, against David Laws, who was the minister in the coalition, one of the ministers in the coalition government for the Liberal Democrats, who had a big majority. And I won it the first time round. I thought it might take more than one go, but I managed to win it the first time round. And 2015 was an interesting time, but I guess I guess through that process of being involved in the local level, not liking what the Lib Dems were doing locally, because it was a Lib Dem firmament there, I also didn't like at all what was going on in the coalition government. And actually, the thing that got me interested enough to want to do it was, in fact, I remember watching the television when David Cameron announced before the 2010 election that he wasn't going to hold a referendum like he said he would do on the Lisbon Treaty, because it had already happened. I thought, you've just lost the election, mate. And what happened? He lost the election. We were in coalition as Conservatives with the Liberal Democrats. And to be honest, a lot of people, I think, in the Conservative Party quite liked that because they are probably more of a Liberal Democrat mind than of a true Conservative mind. But that meant that, 2015 became very interesting because it was a chance to actually be a Conservative government, obviously, on their own. We've heard a lot in the recent election campaign about you've had 14 years and all the rest of it. But actually, I don't regard that first term as a Conservative government at all.
Well, I suppose it will arguably be the terms that followed. You could make the case. But so is it because that you had a strong local base? Because my understanding is that one of the first things David Cameron did when he came in as leader was he started to rig the selection process. So the power was effectively taken away from the local constituencies and placed with the party chairman. Hmm. So is it a result of your strong local base that meant that you got selected while having Conservative opinions? Because I thought you guys had been filtered out by then already.
Well, your assessment, I think, is actually correct. And I want to place on record my gratitude to my local association there for supporting me. They indeed saw that I could win things at a local level that weren't supposed to be winnable. So the idea for them of me standing for the parliamentary seat, which should on paper have looked unwinnable, seemed possible to them, and I'm grateful to them for that chance. Mm-hmm. And yes, I sort of had a local footprint already, and obviously had a bit of a following there. And so that was something that was easy to lean in on. And it was an open primary under which I was selected to fight the seat. So which means that that anybody can turn up. You don't have to be a Conservative member to be a part of that. And I won that on the first round, so that all worked. That all worked well. But I've always seen myself as a small C Conservative first, rather than a really partisan party political person. I haven't been a member of the Conservative Party since I was a teenager, like some, for example. But I've always been always regarded myself as a Conservative.
Because I kind of mentally draw a line at 2010, those members who joined before and after, and perhaps there are some exceptions, such as in your case. Mm. But, I mean, not naming any names, we're not going to name Alicia Kearns here or any of the other sort of ultra-liberal Tory MPs that came in the sort of more recent years. But was there a genuine distinction that you could pick up on inside the party, inside the parliamentary party, between those sort of pre-2010 MPs and basically the cohort that came after?
It's interesting. I think to be fair to my ex-colleagues, they are a very broad church. There are lots of different types of people in there politically, and that can be a strength. And I think it has in some times been a strength, but it can also be a weakness when the electorate really wants you to do things, because it can mean that some of the disagreements are more insurmountable than they might be at other times. And I think the recent experience since 2015 has been where those sorts of what would be bridgeable chasms in normal times have turned out to not really be bridgeable, because there are different principles at work within people's opinions about, and obviously Brexit was a big deal, which we'll probably come on to, but in terms of the differences about how one regards the law, what the law is, what it's supposed to do, what Britain's place is, and what its constitutional arrangements are, these are quite fundamental to some of the technical differences that are there that have caused colleagues to have differences of opinion. When the populace has made a choice, it's going on to the 2019 election, that was clearly a choice that they voted then in the populace generally again to uphold for change based on the new constitutional arrangement. And some people were prepared to do that, and other people weren't, as they'd proved over the previous years with the fights during Theresa May's time. And in a sense, yeah, just going back to the, it's a great shame in a way, because I don't think we've had a Conservative government doing normal Conservative things for a long time. Part of that was because we were first in coalition with the Liberals. Second, because we had to spend 3 years, it turned out, arguing about how to implement the Brexit vote. And that took up a lot of time and energy, as we know. It was Boris who unblocked that thing. And then we had various decisions that made that difficult. And then COVID came straight away and took all the rest of the oxygen for the whole parliament. So, yeah, I completely understand why people say, well, you've had all this time, you haven't done Conservative things. But there are there are good reasons why that happened, but that doesn't make it any less frustrating.
I wonder if, even if it was plain sailing, a very boring news cycle throughout that period, whether the Conservatives would have done Conservative things anyway. I don't think that... I mean, well, let's go through them.
I mean, I like to think that they would. I value my ex-colleagues, and I think most of them are in it for the right reasons, and they want to do the right thing, and their instincts are Conservative. But I think there's just been so much, there's been so much noise and so much principled difference that it's quite hard for me to see how some of those things go back together and how you can have agreement on a broad set, a broad enough set of small C Conservative principles now.
Well, let's dig into those principles. Yeah. I mean, because I would no longer identify myself as a Conservative on the basis of the utter betrayal of the last few years. But if I were going to attach myself to principles that I call Conservative, they would be things like small state, low taxation, national sovereignty, the primacy of the family over the state, those kind of things. But I get the impression that even that fairly limited selection of criteria were not universally upheld within the parliamentary party.
Yeah, that is fair to say. There were, I think, a lot of, some of the people that are there in the parliamentary party do instinctively gravitate more towards a social democratic type model. They try to emulate Blair, George Osborne and David Cameron famously saw themselves as the heirs to Blair and called him the master. And that kind of tells you what you need to know about it, really.
So they
modernizer project within the Conservative Party that they were 100% part of, that's actually been going on for decades.
Yes.
But it is the left of centre wing of the Conservative Party that was in control for all those key moments and key times. And going back to the personnel issues, the selection of candidates has clearly been of that ilk too. So I would say there is a the great majority now of Conservative MPs are more on that centre or even centre-left Blair territory, perhaps even to the left of Blair. And we can talk about that in a minute too, because I think the new Labour government seems to be wanting to position itself now to the right of where some of the economic terms, to the right of where the Conservative Party as currently constituted is.
Yeah, I mean, one of the guys here, Carl, at a live event, he made the quip that he might vote for Labour because it's the most right-wing party available. And I sort of laughed at the time, but actually, as you get closer to the election, it becomes increasingly true.
I don't know if they really understand what it is. I think they're a bit of a hodgepodge, right? They are doing some of the right things in terms of thinking about how you get the right homes in the right places. I actually came into politics partly because the Lib Dems were planning all the wrong homes in the wrong places. So I know a bit about the whole planning system. But there is no doubt that we need to build more houses in this country, and they're right to focus on that, because young people need to be able to see a path to owning their own homes. Part of it's about building more houses. The other part's about enabling them to genuinely grow their incomes by growing their ability to do valuable work that other people want to pay for. That's the only solution, actually, to them being able to afford the higher prices, which are always going to be there, however many homes.
The pushback from the right for that would be, well, if you look at the stats, the native-born population is actually declining. The increased demand for home is partially due to the way that people live now, which is more atomised. But a large part of it is also the mass immigration that we've been experiencing. So actually, you could solve a lot of those sort of things together.
Well, talking about my own ex-constituency, that is not that isn't a mass immigration place. However, there is a lot of pressure on housing. There is that atomization, as you mentioned. The households are getting smaller in size on average, and that is driving demand for more units. But I was always a fan of trying to build on the massive infrastructure investment that we were doing through the A303 dualling, to actually think about putting a new town in an area that was appropriate for one, up on the A303 there. And that would have been an ideal way of actually doing something that would attract investment, attract people to the region. And it is hard to recruit in our rural areas. It's hard to recruit teachers medical personnel and dentists and all these things. So that was a part of my theory for how you attract people to the area without putting pressure on existing communities. But unless you're going to build the infrastructure for extra people, wherever they come from, then that's always going to be a challenge for any population, because there's competition for those public resources.
So give us a flavour of what it's like working inside the Parliamentary Conservative Party over your tenure, because I sort of imagine that, you know, friendships must form and groups must form and cliques must form, and I'm sort of imagining something like a small disaffected group who actually believe in conservative things sort of forming like minds, and then a much larger sort of socially liberal group, basically a group of people who, if the Liberal Democrats were more electorally successful, if we had a three-party system, they wouldn't have joined the Conservatives in the first place. They would have joined the Liberal Democrats to begin with. So how does it shape up actually inside the party?
There are different... I think you need to go back to what people actually want to get out of politics in the first place. And I think there are quite a lot of people who seem to work in politics, work as MPs. I'm not going to name any names, but there are people who want to do it because it's, in theory, a high status type occupation. It's a thing where you can make a difference, but there are lots of people who are there to, because they want to have a career in it rather than necessarily wanting to do anything to rock the boat or radically change things. It's an institution like there are other institutions, and there are quite a lot of people who want to join in for that reason and to be part of that, and they find it interesting. They might find the media stuff interesting. They might find all sorts of, they might have very good local community reasons for wanting to change things in their local community. So I'm not saying that that's not valuable. I'm just saying that's not necessarily a cadre of people who is going to want to get involved in thinking about issues of principle or constitutional change or these sorts of things that are slightly more theoretical at first, but then translate themselves into potentially quite radical mechanisms by which you can change things for people. And I think the Conservative Party, with its name as Conservatives, it has over a long period of time attracted people who are those more establishment types who essentially don't want things to change very much. And they there are lots of them who essentially want a relatively quiet life rather than a controversial life or a radical life. And
that is
what they would see being conservative as a word is about. And I can understand how they got there, but I don't actually think that's not what the broad base of small C Conservative Party people in the country actually want from a Conservative Party. They want a centre-right bloc that does and thinks in small C Conservative ways and actions that are going to that are going to help change people's lives. And that's my concern, is that it's that establishment type has totally lost a sense of the fact that there is the vast majority of people in the country are that small C conservative, which includes people of all classes. And the people who want to get on in life and go up the ladder, they really need our help. And when we are essentially saying to them through our policy choices, well, we don't actually care quite so much about that. We're not really going to change things for you. We prefer just to, you know, we prefer to do our own thing that's comfortable for us. They understandably, I think, get angry. And that's what's happened in the last election. Those C2, CDE type conservatives who were there in 2019 for us were there in 2015. I remember it.
Yes.
They just didn't come out for us, and or they voted Reform.
But I mean, it's a fundamentally different proposition being conservative in the sense of conserving the institutions pre-Blair as opposed to post-Blair, because, of course, the institutions have been markedly changed. Mm. And actually, this is my key criticism of coming back to David Cameron, is you say, yeah, the whole heir to Blair stuff. The point with Blair was that he was coming in and he was taking all of the power out of government and moving it into quangos and then operating them with his friends and structuring in such a way that they would always be operated by his friends.
Yeah.
And what Cameron came in and did was he copied the veneer of fluff, the messaging that went over the top of Blair without understanding what Blair was actually doing. So picking up more on David Cameron, of course, the first big failure that I can think of would be the Brexit issue. So what was it like being in the Conservative Party, and what was it like to live through being inside the parliamentary Conservative Party over that whole Brexit span?
Yeah. Well, the thing that I remember most about the initial phase of that was David Cameron in the cabinet room with our 2015 intake in there, and he was briefing us on what he was trying to do with the renegotiation of our sort of terms of membership with the EU. And he essentially said to us that he was going to ask for just enough for us to be able to win the Brexit referendum, of basically persuading the country that that was good enough to stay in.
So it sounds like he was uncomfortable with that he was asking for just enough because he had to, because the people were demanding it, but he didn't want to.
I think that may be part of it. I can't speak for him on that particularly, but I think for one reason or another, he was not ambitious in that renegotiation, and the EU would have sensed that completely. In life, in business, in politics, in everything, I think you have to be very clear and you have to be very bold and you have to say what you want and work back from there. Either he didn't know what he wanted or he didn't really want to be very ambitious about it. But I thought at that moment, I thought that doesn't sound like a great starting point for a negotiation.
Yes.
You know, people on the other side of any negotiation, they have a level of respect for you in that, when you are clear about what you want and saying, look, for these X, Y, and Z perfectly good reasons, we actually need things to change here. And that was his chance, actually, to positively change the EU. Maybe they would have responded to it, done something more about national populations' need to be involved in decision making, etc., and maybe that would have changed.
But is that how communication in the parliamentary Conservative Party always was? It was top down. Was there much? Did you ever get the opportunity to put your views to leadership, or was it purely, by the way, guys, this is what we're doing, like it or lump it?
It's they call it an elected dictatorship, right? The or something tempered by regicide. I think, you know, there is a very leader heavy authority path within the Conservative Party within Parliament. It's partly that's the system. I mean, the system of the patronage of being in government and being able to give jobs out, etc. That tends to be, I guess it tended in the old days to be run more like a military operation. So the whips would often be ex-military, and they would think of discipline in those sorts of ways where you essentially just followed orders. And that was,
yes.
I'm not saying that there were not opportunities to make your views known. And of course, Parliament is one of those opportunities itself. To make your views known to the executive, but the
but what really could you have done? Because voters often feel a sense of frustration that we only ever get to vote once every 4 years.
Mm.
But what power does a parliamentarian actually have over their leadership? Because of course, you can disagree a little bit.
Yes,
you can even rebel once or twice. Yeah. But if you make yourself too much of a problem, they just take the whip away from you, and then you'll lose your seat.
In order to be constructive, particularly when you're a party in government, you have to do a lot of closed door and corridor type, and tea room type talking to ministers, trying to talk to them about the issues that they are trying to deal with, and trying to persuade them of your slightly different way of thinking about it, or maybe going about it. And
to watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.